and welcome back to another Ramble Cast. Alex Navarro, Brad Shoemaker. Let's get right into it. Alex Navarro, how was the show?
Oh, right. Yes, I actually did a thing, didn't I?
Yes.
I played the show Saturday with Sick of It All, Sub-Zero, Mava, and Ake.
Uh-huh.
We opened up the show. We had a few folks who were Giant Bomb / Nextlander fans come out, said, hey, nice to see them.
Great.
A couple of things just kind of in the lead up here. So get there, set up, get all pretty much good to go. Remember we talked about the whole videoing the show? Is anyone going to be recording? Is any of that stuff going to be going on?
And it was like that guy who does all the, might be there, the guy who does all the hardcore scene videoing, right?
Yeah, 856, Sonny is his name. So we get there, and our guitar player is like kind of walking around looking for a place to set up his GoPro, because, you know, I mean, that's just kind of what he does at every show. And then another guy walks up to him, and he's like, hey, so I'm already videotaping this entire show, and I have, like, an actual, like, cam set up and everything. Also, Sonny's here.
Okay.
And immediately, like, so he came over to us and was like, hey, by the way, Sonny's here.
No pressure.
And so, no pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
And, the blood just straight up drained out of my face, like 100%. Like, oh, fuck.
So you last time, I don't remember, you did not know if Sonny would come or not, but the Sonny coming means this is like, basically means this is like a legit show now.
Well, it was always a legit show. Yeah. It's just, it was one of those things of like, I mean, no one had said anything about it.
Yeah.
I assumed they were probably maybe trying to surprise Flora with it or something. I don't know. Because, I mean, you just pay him. He'll come out and record your show.
Like, but he releases his stuff kind of like a...
on his channel.
yeah, right. Like, it is like the Criterion of hardcore. Like, you know...
Kind of, yes.
Oh, Sonny recorded this show. It means it made his curation.
To be clear, he does not exclusively film hardcore, though that is the primary thing that he does, and like those are the primary shows that he covers, but he does a lot of other heavy music and other things as well. But like, I think he's one of the best music videographers that's out there right now.
Does he get a, do you know if this might be too much in the weeds, and I'm sorry for asking the weeds questions, but does he get a drop out of the boards for the audio, or is it kind of the ambient audio?
It really depends on the show, but usually he tries to get a drop out of the boards. There are some shows I've seen that he recorded that were literally like outdoor shows that sounded better than some indoor shows I've seen recorded, and he was definitely getting like the live mix. But it's not just that he's getting the live mix, it's that he's really good at making the live mix sound good in his videos.
That's
so
cool. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure you haven't seen it because it was just this weekend, but did he record the entire show? Because it was long, right?
So I don't know is the thing.
Okay.
But when we got up on stage, right at about 3 p.m., Sonny was there on the left-hand side of the stage, and as soon as we launched into the intro, I basically forgot how the intro went.
Uh-oh.
I recovered. I did not, like, fuck it up, but I was definitely like, wait, what do I do? Oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fuck. Like, my mind was, like, racing. And then after the set, I talked to my guitar player, and he was like, I had the exact same thing happen to me. I saw him, and I forgot. Like, you can see it in, like, there were some other recordings. Yeah. Like, there were some floating around YouTube recordings of our set, at least, and a couple of the other ones. You could see him, like, accidentally hit a note, like, a little too early at the beginning, then recover, and he's fine. But
That's
it's just, like, the Sonny effect was there, and I think none of us were, like, prepared for it.
It's always Sonny in New York hardcore.
Yeah, totally.
That's awesome. So that might be, no guarantees, but there might be something floating around there at some point.
Yeah. There are recordings of our set that are floating around. Some are just single songs. There is, I think, at least one full YouTube recording of our set out there if you go look for it.
Cool.
But yeah, we played. I will say I think I did okay.
Okay,
for not
great.
Having played in front of people in almost 2 years. And only having a couple of rehearsals under my belt. You know, there's a few moments where I'm like, you know, my tempo's a little all over the place here, but I didn't forget any of the parts. That's really the part that I was worried about, and I didn't, so.
And the rest of the band held up their end of the bargain as well? Great.
Definitely. I mean, look, we were all a little out of practice, but I think we availed ourselves well. You know, obviously the full crowd was not there at the very beginning of the show, but I'd say there was probably at least 150 people there, and enough of them were enthusiastic and circle pitting and doing what they do at these kinds of shows that I was very happy about it.
And the
kind of camera rig is Sonny rocking.
So he has a handheld that he was kind of holding up. Like, it really depends on the stage setup, because there are times if it's a bigger stage, he will set up a drum cam that is just on the drummer. He sometimes has like two cameras going on, you know, from either side of the stage, depending on what availability is. This was a good size stage, but not big enough for him to be up on it while we were doing stuff. So it seemed like it was just him one side of the stage filming most of the time.
What's his name one more time?
I forget his last. I think it's Sonny Singh.
Or I mean, just his like his YouTube channel.
It's Hate56.
Hate56. I see.
Is he an older gentleman?
I kind of want
to. No, he's like my age. Maybe, okay. Maybe a little younger.
Trying to think of 5'6".
Oh God, he has a Wikipedia page. I kind of want to look at some of his work.
Oh, you should. There's a lot. Like, I mean, one, there's a lot of it, but you know, if you want some suggestions for a few sets of his that I think are some of his best work, there is a set from a band called The 68 from a year or two ago. It was on one of the last Every Time I Die shows. They were an opener. They're just a two-person band, but it is one of the most dynamically filmed pieces of live audio I've seen in a very long time. There's another one from a band called Gel where they are playing in the parking lot of a Sonic drive-in.
Okay.
That sounds incredible for being recorded in the parking lot of a Sonic drive-in. And, you know, there's a lot of other, like, there's a very famous one from this band, Harm's Way, which is another hardcore band, where the guy is doing this dance in the middle of it that sort of became a meme. It's a good set, but also the guy, the shirtless hardcore guy, is just doing this dance in the middle of the set that became a thing.
I am on his YouTube channel. Sure enough, that is the most popular video by far, and
not
that
surprised.
Is a frightening-looking gentleman.
Yeah, he's a beefy guy.
That's a large man.
Yeah.
It's like Henry Rollins times two.
Whoa.
Or something.
Big dudes are a thing in hardcore, for sure.
But, yeah, that dude works out. These look really professional.
Yeah.
Like
Sonny has really honed his craft, I feel like, in the last few years, but he was always, like, better. I felt like better at this than a lot of other people are.
It's like, fuck, it's so crazy when you see, like, some clip go around on Twitter of just like, here's Green Day playing at their high school in 1991.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just, like, single camcorder shot, like, maybe zooms in and out a little bit occasionally, like, some students walk in front of the frame.
And the built-in camcorder mic from 1991.
Right. Yeah.
Little, like, digital date down in the lower right or whatever. Yeah. Like, this stuff looks like it could be on TV. Like, it's so awesome that things have gotten this good. I wonder if is he doing any of those, like, MTV Gonzo, like, just like running up and back and forth, like zoom in at the stage type stuff. I wonder.
Not really. I mean, he's usually pretty, like, he wants to be the fly on the wall. He doesn't really want to, like, insert himself, at least from the stuff I've seen. It seems like he's always trying to keep a distance. And from what I saw from this show, he really did just kind of sit in the corner and not really make himself known for the most part. I think he does. Like, I think the thing he maybe is trying to avoid is the thing that I felt, which was the Sonny gaze on you. You know,
it's a very like Baudrillard style. Like once you witness it, you have changed the state of the thing. Like it
yeah, exactly.
That's very fun though. Do you know? I'm sure you were there. How was the rest of the show?
Oh, it was fantastic. Like the thing I'll say for this show is that, as nervous as I was and as glad as I was that we managed to get through our set, the vibes there were fucking immaculate.
Cool.
Like, you know, it's always a crapshoot. Sometimes you get a somewhat disinterested crowd that's really only there for the headliner. Sometimes you get, like, a really enthusiastic crowd that's just kind of down for whatever is going on.
Uh-huh.
This felt more like the latter. So, you know, Ache is a band I think we've played with before. I always enjoy them. They're a little bit more metal than straight hardcore, but like they're real good. They played a solid set, and then Maffa came on, which is Flora's band, the woman whose birthday we were celebrating, and she brought in this group. I believe they're called Mbembe. They are a Brazilian drum corps.
Whoa!
That I think she has at least some. I don't know if she's in it or if she just is like knows the people that are in it. But in the middle of their like during their set, like there were just these straight up like percussion breakdowns happening on the floor with like these seven or eight drummers in front of their, because they have a djembe player in their band, but then they were also adding this element on top of it, which made it kind of wild.
They played along with Flora's band.
With her band.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's because cool. Her whole, like, Maafa is very much like a, they build themselves as Afro-progressive hardcore. Like, it is, like, she's Afro-Brazilian, like, there's a lot of, like, you know, like, Brazilian rhythms kind of mixed into a lot of the stuff that they do. And it's really neat. And the way they kind of implemented that stuff in the show was really cool. The lead guy from Abembe got up and then did some additional hand drumming with them during the set. You could tell he had not really practiced with them, but he was having a fun time trying to keep up with what they were doing. It was cool.
Again, the good vibes.
Yeah, very good vibes. Right. Like, everyone was just down for what they were doing. And then Sub-Zero and Sick of It All played. That was when the crowd really got thick at that point.
Uh-huh.
Sub-Zero is a cool band. Like, I had never had the chance to see them before. They have a real 90s hardcore feel to them live. Like, it is that real, like, I don't know how to describe it other than to say they aren't this, but I feel like there is definitely that element of, like, edgy meathead hardcore, like, just, you know, yeah, bro, like, it's all for the scene, man. You know, we're here, we're down. Like, yeah, I'm doing a bad impression, but they're a really good band, and they were very tight live, and I was very excited to see them. But then Sick of It All gets on, and they are just the most jovial motherfuckers. It is amazing. Like, they've been doing this shit since 1986, and they're definitely, you know, they're older now, but their energy is so upbeat and so, like, it never felt like they were doing anyone a favor by being on that show. They seemed really enthusiastic and way into it the entire time, which was really rad.
That's those cool.
Those dudes have to be pushing 60, if not over.
Yeah, I think late 50s, bare minimum. And, you know, the guy, like, the lead singer at one point was even like, yeah, I had to dye my hair before this show. You know, like, it's just, you know, otherwise I'd be looking like this guy in the crowd with nice. Point at someone with gray hair, so... But it was really cool. I had never seen them live either, and their energy was fucking fantastic.
Were you able to kind of just, like, hang around in the wings, or are there no wings on that stage?
There were definitely no wings on that stage. Like, it was a decent-sized venue. It's like a 400-person venue. Mm-hmm. So I mostly hung off to the, if you're facing the stage, kind of the left side.
Okay.
Which is sort of where the merch stuff was. There's a little, like, railing that was kind of between the floor and where the merch stuff was. I was just on the other side of that railing watching most of the time. And you'll appreciate this, Vinny.
Yeah.
There were a few little kids there. Like, and I say little, I mean, like, between the ages of, like, 6 and 8.
Did they have, like, big old hearing protection things on?
Yes, okay. Giant headphones on, all of them. But the kid in front of me looked definitely no older than 6.
That's cool.
And the whole time he was like, I want a stage dive, like, the people. Because when Sub-Zero and Sick of It All got up there, people just started stage diving like crazy, like in a way I've not seen in a while.
Were they being caught?
The ones that weren't didn't seem any worse for the wear. Okay. Most of them did get caught, and, you know, it didn't seem like anyone suffered any grievous injuries. But so what ended up happening is the kid's dad was just like, okay, jump up on the railing and I'll catch you, and it'll be like you're stage diving.
Okay.
It was really sweet.
That's fun. Please don't climb the railing. Thank you.
No.
Did you keep your hearing protection in after your set?
Oh, I never took that shit out. Yeah. Like, it was too loud in there for me not to. And I still had some ear ringing, even with the earplugs, when I got done.
Just on the hearing protection stuff, Alex, you and I have been to the same multiple weddings in the last month and a half or so.
Oh, my God.
Does it feel like there is, like, noise escalate or loudness
like
wars
like a tyranny
happening?
Of noise? Yeah. Yeah. Like, absolutely.
Extremely loud music. At Drew's wedding, not so much. It was kind of in the dance floor area.
It was loud, but it wasn't horrendous.
Yeah, but holy cow. The
other wedding we went to, it wasn't horrendous, but it was definitely like we were all in the same room where the music was happening, and the DJ was like, there's no chance you're going to have a conversation while this is going on.
Yes.
Outside. Anyway, here's Katy Perry. Enjoy.
Yeah.
Drew's had some nice segmentation.
Yes.
The sort of different rooms adjacent.
Yeah. It was funny because like I was at one other wedding too, and they're loud, or I'm old. I don't know. It's
it could be both.
Yeah, it could be both. But it's the loudness. I mean, look, my kids, when they play and do stuff, if they were at that concert, they would also wear hearing protection. When I went to concerts, I didn't, and I probably should have worn hearing protection going to all the shows when I was growing up. Protect your ears. Protect your other senses. Protect your ears. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you always wear hearing protection when you were drumming?
No. No, I was terrible about it when I was a teenager. I was like, oh, no, man, you know, I'm never going to die. I'm never going to go deaf. I can do anything. And then by about the time I hit 16, I was like, I need custom earplugs because if I don't do this now, I'm going to lose my hearing.
Okay. Do you have custom ones, though? Like fitted ones?
Not anymore. Okay. I lost one of them somewhere along the way, but I do have these other ones that have like basically like a little switch on them that lets you adjust the amount of filtration.
Whoa, that's cool. Yeah. They're electronic? Okay, so you're not...
No, they're not electronic. It's just it's a little plastic switch that basically just like adds an extra filter when you turn it on, like when you move the switch.
Oh, so it's just mechanically filtering?
It's just mechanical, yeah.
Whoa, that's cool.
Yeah.
I could see why not wearing them would be a pain in the butt if you're like pitch and tone wise and stuff, but I just feel like for drumming, you kind of
have to.
Right?
Yeah. You absolutely have to, because I don't know a drummer ever. I've never met one that did not have at least a tiny bit of hearing loss.
Mm, okay. Yeah. And those shows are loud, especially smaller, even smaller venues. I feel like the smaller venues are really have to look out, because big speakers in a smaller venue can be.
Dumb. Oh, totally. Yeah. And where I was not getting the speakers just blown right at me. Like, it was kind of off from that, but it was still loud enough that, like, I kept the ear protection in the whole time.
Sounds fun.
Yeah, it was a really good time. I was glad we were able to do it. Felt good to be up there again. As I said, you know, there is at least one version of our set out there on YouTube if you wanted to go try and find it. We'll see if it ends up on Hate56 or not. Again, it's up to the patrons. It's up to his patrons to vote for it, so we'll see.
That's also, okay, that and Nextlander, of course. I think great uses of Patreon. Like, that sounds like a thing. Like,
yeah.
Could you make a living going out and recording these bands, you know? And then I assume you would, in the past, I'm dating myself here, but you kind of pass the tapes around, right? You know, it's not like a thing that a lot of people pay for. Somebody buys one.
Keep distributing the tapes.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then, like, somebody might make a copy and you give them $5 or something like that. What a great thing for Patreon to support somebody who can maybe at least pay for the gigs or travel or whatever, to have enough people support that thing that probably wouldn't make enough money on its own, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he gets a fee now when he goes out and does a show, if he's hired for it.
He's booking shows.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he does that for every single show that he records, but, like, definitely there are times when people will fly him out for a fee to go, record their show. But, I mean, it's led to him being able to do things like go on tour with Rage Against the Machine. You know, like, he did the Turnstile record release show a couple of years ago, which was another big one in Baltimore. And so he's, like, getting work out of this stuff.
That's rad.
That is even beyond just sort of like the scene that he kind of, you know, came up in.
Is Rage still a thing? Didn't De La Rocha leave at some point?
Oh, for a long time, they were not a thing.
Are they back to being a thing? What is...
They were as of a couple of years ago. They did a big reunion tour.
Oh, he's back in. I see.
Yeah, he was back in.
There's plenty to rage about.
All right. Yep.
I think Tom Morello is also, like, teaching kids.
Probably.
Doesn't Tom Morello have a PhD in something?
I want to say yes. I think he was, like, okay, now I'm just might be...
Well, they were a college band, so it would make sense.
I think he's, like, a Harvard grad? Is that
no,
right?
It wasn't Harvard. It was California, I think.
Was it? Okay.
I think.
I don't remember his bona fides, but I'm pretty sure he was teaching somebody, and I think it was kids.
Maybe he's teaching now there, but like
like little kids. He had like a little like a music program for like introducing kids to making weird sounds on their guitar. Hey, just throw your toys on the guitar.
Yeah.
Okay. He did go to Harvard. I think he only has a bachelor's though, I'm seeing here. I might be mixing him up. Maybe I'm thinking of Brian May, who has like an advanced physics degree. I can't remember. Exactly. He might be a PhD.
Dr. May.
Yes, Brian May is a PhD.
Okay. Dr. May, thank you.
In astrophysics, actually.
It's great.
He's got a PhD in astrophysics. Bruce Dickinson has a commercial pilot's license. Like, the UK guys are just doing it different.
And Tom Morello, my favorite UK guy.
Morello. Is that Morello?
Okay, I think Morello. I've said Morello my whole life. No eye in there? No eye snuck in there?
No, as far as I know.
Okay.
Nope.
But yeah, them getting back together is a pretty recent thing, because I think pretty much past that Battle for Los Angeles album, the one that was all their covers, that was the one that was after it. Whatever the covers album was, they didn't really do anything after that. Like, the other guys went off and formed Audio Slave.
Right.
Zach DeLaRocca was doing some other side projects for a long time. I think the reunion was pretty recent, and I'm not sure that it's intended for them to, like, do another album or anything. I think they mostly were just doing a tour.
Okay. Wikipedia says is, which, of course, Wikipedia is the ultimate authority.
Uh-huh. Yeah, if it's an is, it is. If it's a was, it was.
Rage Against the Machine is a band, is what it currently says. So.
Yeah.
Source data.
One of my favorite things about Tom Morello is how high he straps his guitar.
Yes.
It's like comically high, but his licks are so sick.
Yeah.
Who's going to say anything about it? He can wear his guitar however he wants.
I think it's rad when you can pull that off. I think he's one of the guitar players who can pull it off.
Yes.
The opposite equivalent is the bass player who rides their bass as low as humanly possible.
Like at the knees, kind of. Oh,
the Sub-Zero bassist was that guy. Okay. He was basically, like, you could see his legs. He was standing as far apart as he could,
uh-huh.
And then they just kept spreading lower and lower, and the bass kept going lower and lower.
Yeah.
But then occasionally he would also just dip and just, like, dive into the audience in the pit while he was playing, so...
I was always taught guitar below the navel, but I also grew up during the grunge and kind of post.
That's the hard rockers way of doing it.
Not like kind of belt level, you know, but below the navel. And I feel like 50s and 60s was like up at the belly, kind of like at the chest, kind of. And like then Beatles the guitar style. Slowly went started going down. But yeah, you know. The arm, elbow up, arm down was the, you know, that's how you're doing those power chords. You're just chugging away, basically, chainsawing your way through those chords.
God, who was the bassist in the 90s that was like, they had their bass down around their knees? I'm trying to think.
I feel like Flea's bass was pretty low, wasn't it?
Flea?
I mean,
not that low.
Okay.
There were a few guys who definitely like were at the like shin level bass.
Also, Flea might just be a smaller human, so maybe it just looks like the bass is is lower.
I mean, he's a Flea.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
I feel like Mike Dirnt from Green Day, actually, he was one of the low riders, too.
That's who I was going to suggest, actually. That's like, yeah. If you asked me, I would have said, yeah, it was Mike Dirnt for sure. But I looked up some pictures, but these are more recent. Seems like he seems to have raised it a bit.
Maybe the back problems set in at a certain point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was definitely a lot of the punk guys. Like, the low bass was very much like a Sid Vicious, like, early punk kind of thing. And I feel like a lot of guys just started emulating that.
Like, how do you reach? Bend over? Like,
I mean, sometimes people just have long limbs is the other thing.
True.
Like, if you have long arms, it's not as big of a problem.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, that's it. Does your band sling them low?
No, Gio, our bass player, like he keeps it at a pretty normal level, okay. Like just kind of waist level. Though our guitar player is a slightly higher up guitar player, so
technical
it's not
player.
Yeah, it's not quite Morello. It's not quite the kind of Paul McCartney like all the way up kind of thing. But
yeah.
It was higher.
Okay,
and I'm kind of a low sitter for drummers.
You are okay.
Yeah, not low, but like lower.
Okay, so snare wise, is it at your knee or is it above your knees?
It's more that I sit low, uh-huh. But I also keep the drums at like the snare needs to be slightly above where the leg line is.
Okay.
Because otherwise, if it's too low, I start whacking my quad a lot while I'm playing, and that's no fun.
Don't whack your quad while you're playing.
Do not whack your quad.
We asked this before, and maybe this will be the last question, technical question at least for the show. Is
I've got answers if you need them. So.
Yeah. Did you wind up bringing and using your own cymbals and pedal and stuff for
everything except for the bass drum and the toms was mine.
Oh, so you wow. So, okay, so you brought your own snare and
yes, I always bring my own snare because you even if they have one you can't trust it
gotcha.
At a venue okay. backline.
But they had hardware for the cymbals and stuff.
Well, so they had their hardware. I chose to use my own because okay. I just their stuff seemed to be in good condition. But I was like, you know what? I've been burned by this by like venue stuff before, so I just bring my own hardware so that I can avoid that altogether.
Did you pack it all in the car?
Yeah, I mean, I have a big hardware case. I just throw all the stands in, and then the rest of the stuff fit in the trunk. I ended up letting like. Basically every band up to Sick of It All use at least some of my stands.
Aww.
Because they were like, they were kind of in the same boat as me of like, yeah, I mean, like the stuff looks fine, but I mean, if you're willing to let me use it, it's like, yeah, it's just stands. Who cares? They're not going to break those.
But they bring their own cymbal. They bring their own cymbals.
They bring their own cymbals, their own snare.
Okay.
And then own kick pedal.
Without the bass drum in the car, I assume that you can fit most.
Yeah,
of
that makes it a lot easier.
Okay, that makes sense.
Do you bring... That said, that hardware case is still in my backseat because I haven't quite brought myself to bring it back in yet. It's pretty fucking heavy.
Well, look, you have a driveway now. You can.
I do.
You don't have to park on the street.
No.
Do you bring extra skins? Like backup
you mean heads?
Skins? Oh, sorry, heads. Yeah.
Yeah.
Drum skins, drum heads. Nobody says what skins,
you,
huh?
What are you, some kind of fucking jazz aficionado from the 50s? What's wrong with you?
Well, you're not tanning your own. You're not tanning your
no,
own.
No, not really.
Okay.
I mean, I do have a backyard now. I guess I could, but no. I probably should, but I had just put new heads on that snare less than a month ago. So I felt pretty confident they weren't going to bust. That said, the floor tom at that venue, there was a big old rip in the middle of the head.
On the top of it? On the
top. The okay. second layer underneath was not ripped, so you could still hit it, and it wasn't, like, broken.
Oh, I see. It was, like, peeling away.
It's like,
away.
Usually there's multiple plies of, especially with, like, clear heads, like, multiple plies of heads. So.
Okay. It was on its way out, though.
It was definitely on its way. I'm pretty sure that Mafa's drummer just straight up put a piece of tape on it before he started playing, so.
Sweet.
Yeah.
All right. That sounds like a lot of fun.
It was, like I said, the vibes were fantastic. And it being a matinee show, I managed to get home before 10 p.m. So really, for an old man like myself, it was kind of a win-win.
Brad, did you get up to anything this weekend? Anything as fun as putting on a hardcore show?
No.
It's hard to
be. No. I'm trying to think of most of what I do is not especially interesting for a podcast.
I mean.
I can tell you the most recent rabbit hole I'm teetering on the edge of.
Uh-huh. Is
kind of pretty morbid, the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami.
Okay, that's okay. Yes,
earthquake and tsunami. I kind of got derailed into reading about that recently, and now I'm thinking about looking up a book or something.
Anything like particular of interest that kind of sparked the journey into this?
It just came something like a video from it came across my Twitter feed.
Okay.
Actually, it wasn't a video. It was some photos. Sorry, this is morbid. I don't know if we really want to get into this. It was a couple. It was like a retired couple who died and like they on the beach. They were on the beach, but their bodies were recovered like a couple weeks later. But then their camera was found like some weeks after that.
Oh, wow.
And on the camera are their vacation photos. And then they took photos as like the waves were coming in. And
oh, so, man. Okay.
So
that
it was
is
just like, here are the last photos that
eerie.
Were on this camera.
Yeah. That is pretty.
Anyway,
eerie.
Like. It just got me interested in the mechanics of how a tsunami works, especially with like an undersea earthquake.
Sure.
And just like what forces are going on there. Like, I've barely looked into this stuff, but like some large undersea earthquakes don't cause tidal waves, but then some smaller ones do. And like, they're not well understood. So like just the science of how these things work is not, they just don't have that many data points to work off of.
And that is what caused that one in 2004.
Yeah, it was one of the biggest earthquakes ever recorded. It was like a 9.1 to a 9.3.
But like deep offshore, like deep in the...
I don't know how far off the coast of Indonesia it was.
Okay.
But
man, that's frightening.
Yeah, I was just reading some like tidal wave do's and don'ts. Like I guess one of the big signs is that the tide rolls back.
Like
yes.
retreats as the wave gets bigger.
Like significantly, yeah. Yes.
Like it straight up reveals the ocean floor for some number of feet.
Yeah.
You know? And basically, it's kind of the thing everybody was saying. Was just like, if you see that, because there's a lot of videos, and like this couple is an example of like videos of just people sort of standing around gawking at it.
I mean, it's weird.
As things were starting to happen, and so everybody was like, hey, the big lesson from this, if you see the water doing this, turn around and run.
But,
yeah.
Like... Okay, I don't want to, again, very kind of morbid. We're talking about people's
lives.
Yeah,
we don't have
it to. Is, but it, also, Brett, I'm just going to say, don't feel too badly about that because I can tell you right now, just about every scientific thing I have ever actually spent any time researching was directly tied to me reading about something incredibly morbid. Like, I don't think that's an uncommon thing.
But
it happens.
If you are close enough to noticeably see the retreat of the water due to the size of the incoming wave, are you too close to get away?
Are you just hosed anyway?
Yeah.
Possibly. I don't know. I'm sure it depends on all kinds of factors.
Okay.
How big the waves are going to be, how far off the coast, et cetera, et cetera.
Like, okay.
Like there's photos of the 2011, not photos, but videos of the 2011 one in Japan and people in cars just outrunning it.
Oh, really?
Like you might hit traffic. Obviously there are like other issues there potentially, but there's one video in particular where like the water is coming in and there are literal houses floating in it. Like full on
behind
most of
people,
most of houses floating in, and it's like a just a roadside camera of like a couple of people driving toward it and seeing what's going on and 3-point turning around as fast as possible. And the last guy literally misses the like the rush of water and debris by like feet.
Really?
Like as he is turning to drive the other direction, like he could not have missed it by more than like 10 to 20 feet.
Oh my God.
And then just took off zooming down the road. Like it's some terrifying stuff.
Well, not to change it from the morbid to the hopeful is maybe with as those things get researched, you get earlier warning systems. And
that was kind of the thing that got me interested was like just the idea that like you feel like science kind of understands most earthly phenomena at this point, right? You know, like I mean, like
not according to some circles for sure.
More than we used to, certainly. Yeah.
Like geological activity, things like that. You know,
things
like. Things involving earth science, you know, generally you assume are mostly well understood, but apparently in this case, there are still a lot they don't know about how these things work. Just limited chances to study them, right?
Well, thankfully, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, maybe more like as like horrific, gigantic natural disasters happen.
I mean, earthquakes are one of those things that, far as I know, you can't attribute to climate change by and large. So those just kind of happen when they happen.
Yes.
But there are other phenomenon that I think we will probably have more opportunity to study as the years wind on.
I'm not fully convinced you can't frack your way into an earthquake, all right?
Oh, no, you definitely can. Oh, yeah, those are different.
Yeah,
you absolutely can. So, I forget what state or multiple states is it that have been fracked?
I think is
fracked
so
Oklahoma
hard,
was having a lot of that too, I think.
That's right.
So I don't think earthquakes are off the man-made disaster chart just yet.
No. I'm just saying that, like, those aren't specifically climate change cause. That's just man being a fucking moron.
You're saying tectonic plate movement, not necessarily.
That's on us.
In
a different way.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we gotta have to deal with that one. Yeah, that stuff's terrifying. I am not sad to be out of, you know, let's say, San Francisco for that particular reason because
that got me thinking about the fact that I live 1.5 miles from the water, you know,
not only a mile and a half from the water but you know along major fault lines, so
this is weird, this jogged a memory, like I have a distinct memory of talking to Ryan about tidal waves at some point around this time, and now that I think about it, it has to have been because of that event, right? Like that has to be why it came up in conversation, right?
Probably,
like especially because, you know, he lived here all his life, so I'm sure he had plenty of time to think about what he would do.
Well, I don't know if I think I mentioned this before, but like when my family moved to California, like not for the first time, but like the first time when I was like aware, like old enough to be aware of it, and when I lived there more or less permanently, we took off for San Francisco like 3 weeks after Loma Prieta.
Is that the big one?
That was the big one in 89. And so we were like, oh, cool, we're moving to the Bay Area. Also, this giant fucking earthquake just happened. And so by the time we finally got there, like the Bay Bridge was closed, obviously, still. And there was still a lot of damage around the Embarcadero and all that stuff. But we drove through the city as much as we could. And you could see, like, just the aftermath of it, like, in a lot of different places. And then when we finally got up to Petaluma, like, the North Bay wasn't that heavily hit, but it definitely got some aftershocks. And there was, like, you know, parts of the sidewalk in front of our new house that had basically cracked since my dad had been out there to, you know, like, to look at the place and, like, sign on for it. So, like, you know, it was just like, hey, welcome to California. Check this shit out.
Yeah. I don't know. California maybe seems due for a big one. I don't know. What's the West Coast?
I don't know specifically about California, but yeah. Because there was the L.A. earthquake also in the 2000s.
I promise this was going to get less morbid, not more. But you really want to read about some shit, Google Cascadia Subduction Zone.
Oh, I know about that one.
That one, like that story is fascinating. Like, again, if you're just interested in like geological science and stuff like that, like the way that they piece together what happened hundreds of years ago in the Pacific Northwest through all kinds of stuff. Have we talked about this before?
I don't think we've talked about it on here.
The word subduction zone on.
Well, so that's the one where it's like there was basically a land mass off the coast of Washington that is just not there anymore, right?
I can't remember exactly what the effects were that they charted. There's the only thing I remember is there is a quote unquote dead forest up there that still is standing, like dead trees. Like I don't know how they're still there, but like there are signs of of the earthquake that happened, but they, I'm trying to remember what all they triangulated, like all these different data points. I mean, obviously like taking samples and stuff like that, but they even went into like, they went into Japanese feudal records from the same time period.
Oh, wow.
Because they also, because Japan was like documenting tidal waves and earthquakes and stuff at that time. And they found a record of a tidal wave hitting Japan at the basically the exact same like day.
Oh wow!
That they had theorized that this massive earthquake happened off the Pacific Northwest.
Sure.
And like were able to find evidence that yes, the thing we think happened did in fact happen at this time.
And it
was big enough to impact both sides of the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah. My recollection from that story, and please forgive me if I'm confusing this with someone's weird fan fiction that they added to it or something, but like my recollection is that there was a story going around before explorers, you know, like white explorers found their way to the Pacific Northwest, where they basically were asking after this, you know, they were asking about like local tribes, you know, natives of the area, and they mentioned this like tribe that lived in the Pacific Northwest that was just gone.
That's exactly it. You're right. I was trying to remember what other evidence they were drawing on, and yeah, like oral history of stuff from hundreds of years ago was part of it.
Yeah, like basically there was a whole tribe that existed in that area that just disappeared off the face of the earth around that time.
Yeah, it's some heavy stuff. I found it's a New Yorker story from like 2015 that I read years ago that is what I'm thinking about here, entitled The Really Big One.
Oh, wow.
I think I read that exact story.
It is haunting as hell.
Yeah.
And it's got like urgency in the modern day because like the idea is basically like, hey, they're not prepared for this. Like,
well, could
like
you
there
be?
There need to be. I think it's been years since I read this. Like, I think they get into some stuff about like
architecture and
I mean
like everything on the West Coast is to a degree earthquake proofed, but what we're talking about here, I think, is something beyond like the average like bad earthquake.
Yeah. Also, I think this is more about, well, I don't know exactly where this is thought to be most likely to happen. Like, I don't know if it's more earthquake or more tidal wave that is the problem with this one.
I mean, there's a lot of cities along the coast on the West Coast. You know, like the biggest cities are all kind of in a very vulnerable coastal area.
Brad, since you are getting into this or teetering on getting into this rabbit hole, my question...
Probably not going to get... This is probably too much for December.
Well, maybe. My general question is the tidal wave stuff, is it basically like wave propagation through the water from the...
Yeah, it's... I think... I mean, I didn't read much about like the physics of it. I assume it's just some like, kind of water displacement
like
kind of
compounding
thing.
Compounding of waves as it travels through... Yeah. Like, and I mean like energy wave, you know? Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's wild. I was only in California. When I was in California, I had maybe like two or three earthquakes I could feel, right?
Yeah.
I remember the first one planted in my mind a respect for the power of nature and the I'm not gonna say I had my like saw the planet Earth from space moment, but like the insignificance of humans like to control it. Like just feeling the Earth move and there's nothing you can do about it.
Nope.
Was it very much a, oh, right. Yeah. If the Earth wants to do something, it's going to do it, and there's nothing you can do about
there's
it.
There's no OSHA standard you can apply to tectonic plates that
or
will
fairness,
make them safer.
Or like it's not fair, or like, you know, right. There's nothing really, and it is, like, you're moving the Earth, right? Like, it's just magnitudes beyond our comprehension of what is powerful and by human standards.
We're ants. We can't do shit.
It really was a very humbling moment of like, you know, luckily it was enough to like maybe make a little book fall off a shelf or something like that. And I did the dumb thing the first time of like stand in front of the bookshelf, which you're not supposed to do.
No.
Heads up.
Doorway. Get to a doorway.
Although as far as fairness goes, like natural disasters, you know, geologic forces, whatever, like certainly do amplify like class stratification in different ways, you know. It's like richer people might be in like more thoroughly earthquake proofed construction than
in areas that are less prone to be mudslides
less advantaged people are always more exposed
or even just we saw this with a lot of the California wildfires, able to recover from a disaster more easily. Like if you lose everything, like, oh, I can afford to live in a hotel or go into another house or do any of those things. Yes, I mean that class stratification for sure. and also populating places that should be is not the right word, but are more prone to have disasters happen, right? Where it's, as populations expand, you know, we will definitely wind up in some Elysium-esque situation where we are all stuck on the
on the dying rock.
Yeah, the dying rock as the floating city, and then we'll just have to cut the tethers and Midgar that shit. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, don't worry though, because if any of the current crop of rich people decide to build the floating city, that thing's going to crash in about 6 months.
Yeah, don't live underneath the plate. Is basically
they are
what
definitely cutting corners
underneath the rotting pizza.
Yep.
Is the name of a song from the Final Fantasy VII soundtrack.
Is it really called The Rotting Pizza?
Underneath the Rotting Pizza, at least that's the translation I've got on mine.
Gross.
I started to say a big one here. It was only about a 4.0, which is not that big in the grand scheme.
That
but
seems
like,
pretty big.
It's noticeable. Yeah.
But it was closer. The epicenter was much closer to the city than most of them. Like, most of the ones we feel are actually, like, I don't know, an hour to a couple hours away. But this one, the epicenter was directly under SFO, actually, which is super weird. I'm surprised that didn't cause more problems.
Yeah.
But, like, that was because that's, like, half an hour from here. Like, that was a good wake-up call of, like, oh, my God, that's a 4.0 when you're close to it.
Oh.
I always feel the 3.6s to 4.0 whatevers, and it's like, I felt a little jitter, you know, but, whatever. But, like, that's a fairly small one in the grand scheme, again. But, like, just being that close to it, I was like, oh, man.
Yeah.
Maybe I should have more supplies around here and stuff than I do.
Yeah, you guys know I have some, like, emergency supplies. And my current thing, I think FEMA says if you can, try to have 3 weeks if you can hold off for 3 weeks without aid, right? I think that's the current FEMA standard, which probably means, hey, look, if you can get away with, like, 6 weeks, that's what you should
do. Considering the way FEMA has been handling the last few big disasters around the country, you would definitely probably want to have a little more than
that. So I think it used to be 2 weeks. They raised it up to three. I generally go for between two and three, and then I consider in the house, like, hey, is there enough water maybe? Is there enough food maybe? For 2 or 3 weeks. And I always consider if it's more than 3 weeks, then something horrible has happened, right? Like, it is like we have reached some kind of, because, you know, again, I should say I live fairly close to a metropolitan zone. I'm not in the country. You know, I'm not in a situation where roads would generally be cut off due to heavy snow or something like that. People who live in the country, much different calculation you have to do. But, like, for an earthquake, that kind of level of recovery, I mean, that's just intense. Like, when you're talking about, like, infrastructure collapse due to something like that, I never knew when I was in San Francisco, I never knew quite how I read a bunch of stuff on earthquake, big earthquakes that had happened and preparing. I just didn't even know where to start. It's just, it's like, you have to get out. You cannot stay there.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, it isn't like a hurricane where, you know, obviously we're vulnerable to those, especially now that we now live in Florida's, you know, tropical environment. You can get a warning about a hurricane. Mm-hmm. You can have time to either leave or batten down and do what you need to do. Obviously lots of people don't heed those warnings, but at least there is the option. There's no warning with earthquakes. They just happen.
And the structural damage is so much different. Like, you know, hurricanes can have structural damage, and you for sure can be
significant
in a situation from a hurricane where you have to be very careful. But, like, you can shelter in place. One could. And I'm not saying you should, but you could ride out. With an earthquake, there might be structural damage you're not seeing in a – especially when – and we all lived in apartment buildings. That stuff's really
– I mean
– can be a little – queasy.
When Sandy came through in 2012, we didn't leave. We just, you know, we just tried to, you know, block up the windows as much as we could and just kind of, you know, hunker down as best we could. And where we were, there was a little bit of flooding, but it wasn't that bad. I mean, obviously other parts of New York got hit way, way harder. So we lucked out, but, you know, there wasn't like a mass evacuation from New York that I recall around that time. It was a lot of like, hey, shelter in place. Hey, don't go out. You know, don't use the subways, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think anyone back then had any real idea that it was going to be as bad as it was.
I do wonder if they would do a mandatory evacuation now, considering, I mean, we've had, you know, the forecast for basically the foreseeable future for wetness in this area is bad news. I don't mean, everybody's probably seen this videos of New York City with its rain problems.
Oh, yeah.
It's...
And they've only barely started to do things like fix some of the subways, make them slightly more, you know, floodproof than they were. Like, they repaired some of the tunnels and, you know, they've done a little bit. But, I mean, every time there's a giant rainstorm, like clockwork, there is a video of someone in some station somewhere where the entire ceiling is just, like, dropping water on you, like you just said, water on you can't do that on television.
Totally, yes. Brad, do you keep any, like, bottled water or, like, a whistle flashlight?
Oh, we really should. Yeah, I mean, I've got stuff like flashlights and whistles. I've got a little crank-powered radio.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Like, water is the big one that I worry about.
Cash?
And unfortunately, yeah, I've got some cash stashed. Yeah. Cash stash. But water is the most important and also takes up probably the most space, which is the unfortunate thing. But, like, that's the thing that, like, A, you'll die the fastest without, and B, seems like it could get the most disrupted with massive structural damage.
Yeah, but it takes up so much space. I was living in apartments. That was always the tough one, was water.
Right.
And then kind of deciding smaller water bottles or one big water thing, because water is also extremely heavy. So if if you have a big water thing and then you're like, I need to leave, then you need to have smaller water things.
Yeah, I'd probably do it by the gallon if I actually
gallon's
did it.
Pretty heavy to carry around.
Yeah.
I kept one of those like Poland Spring cases of water at the bottom of a closet to just be able to throw a couple of bottles in a backpack. I always assumed if an earthquake were that bad, whether I'm digging into that water, I'm probably getting out of there, right? Like, I'm probably filling a backpack and trying to get somewhere. You know, I didn't have a car for a long time, so trying to get to some center or something. I don't know. But disaster stuff is horrifying because you have to basically study disasters to know what happens in a disaster, and they're always miserable. They're always, it's kind of like you were saying, Brad, the people who are most at risk wind up being the ones that are taking the advantage of the most. Because if you can just get in your plane or your car or your boat and leave the area,
and
then
just fly to your private abandoned missile silo that you bought.
Yeah. It's when you have to stay, you know, in the housing with nothing, right? Like you're kind of at the mercy of whatever the situation is, right? When you have no agency in it, that's always terrifying.
There was a movie I don't know why this just reminded me of this. There was a movie I remember making the rounds some years ago. It was not a good movie by any stretch, as far as I could tell. But the trailer was making the rounds because it was a movie about people on a private plane, and then suddenly the ground was gone.
Oh.
Everything was on fire. You could not land, whatever. And everyone was just sort of musing about that. It's like, yeah, I guess that's a concept for a movie. What if the ground was just gone and you were in an airplane? That would suck.
You just can't land.
Yeah. I mean, disaster, look, we're being serious about this stuff and we're thinking about it very realistically. Let's be honest. It's not like humanity hasn't just treated disasters as just like amusing pornography for themselves, you know, especially in movies over the last couple of decades. Like, it feels like a lot of big budget cinema between like the late 90s and the early, or let's say the late aughts, was almost exclusively built around finding ways for Roland Emmerich to blow up whatever part of the world he was going to blow up.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget, at the turn of the millennium, like the end of the world was basically the zeitgeist. Yeah. It was the, you know, come the year 2000, for one reason or another, we weren't going to make it.
And then they pushed that off to 2012 and blamed the Mayans, and then that wasn't it either. Yeah. And then I feel like kind of trailed off after that for a little bit. I mean, there's still disaster movies, but there aren't as many.
We're going to do ourselves in pretty slowly, but accelerate at an accelerated pace. So it's not the sexiest one, but you know, it's not as sexy as a meteor hitting the earth or
at least that'd be quick,
a mass extinction event, but you know, yeah, right, exactly.
I'm curious about this movie that just premiered on Netflix, Leave the World Behind. I think it's based on a book. I don't have Netflix anymore. Maybe I should just read the book.
That's
instead.
The one with Julia Roberts, right?
Yeah, I didn't know that until I just Googled it, but I do see her doing interviews about it.
Yeah,
I think it's like,
I've seen very mixed reviews.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it was like perfectly received, but I think it's I get the impression it's kind of like about the after effects of a disaster without actually focusing on the disaster.
Yeah,
it's like, it's not the Emmerich style disaster porn. It's more about the sociological aspects of people not having access to cell signal and stuff like that anymore.
But it's also not like Mad Max or you know, like The Road, like just misery slash ridiculous. Like, I think it's trying to take it somewhat seriously, though, again, I haven't seen it, so I don't know how effective it is at it, but I think it's trying to thread a needle there.
I mean, the kind of academically, the good and bad is there is plenty of information to draw from. Like, there have been plenty of disasters where people have had to, you can look and see what happens, right? Like, what is the not Hollywood version of this? What should you be prepared for? One of the interesting things I thought I remember reading was a lot of people who were survivors of big disasters said, bring back, I didn't realize this, but you should pack hearing protection or earplugs. Because if you're in a shelter, it's very loud and they don't turn the lights off. So it's not like quiet time. So if you have to stay in a shelter, bring earplugs, especially for kids, because it can be extremely loud and hard to sleep. And I was like, oh man, that's something I never would have thought about to put in a bag.
No.
What are they? Sleep masks. Because the lights don't go. It's not like they just turn the lights off, or at least this is what I read, in a shelter at night. So I was like, man, that's really interesting. And that's not a sexy fact, right?
No.
That's just a kind of, this sucks kind of fact. Also,
but the kind of things that, like, the average person just is absolutely not thinking about.
Totally. And maybe shouldn't, but, you know, or unfortunately, maybe you should. I don't know. I have a different mindset on that stuff where my thing is, like, the longest I can stay without having to interact with a large crowd is my whole planning method. Because of my cynicism with people, and I just don't necessarily want to be in a big crowd if something bad is happening, right? Like, I don't want to be in the line if the last bottle of water gets handed out. That stuff just seems so rough. I want to see if I can avoid that. Anyway, thanks, Brad, for this enlightening topic. I was going to talk about Christmas shopping, but why?
Well, that went in a different direction then.
Yeah. Well, maybe. I don't know. I haven't been in a store for it in a while.
Yeah.
Here you go, son. I got you 6 gallons of potable water.
Make sure you mark it and then turn it over every year and a half.
I got you a journal so you can document what's left of humanity following days.
That's right. This is a kit to attach spikes to car tires so you can wear them on your shoulders. Get in there early. I think I finished my Christmas shopping.
Okay.
And it stressed me so much out because my kids are at an age now where they're transitioning from, like, toys to things that are not toys, let's say, like services and goods.
Yeah. And things that are still amusing to them but are not just, like, the things a child plays with.
Well, the things that, like, you'd be like, what you really just want is your own phone. Or what you really want is your own PlayStation 5. Or what you really want is your own iPad. You're not getting any of those things, but that's what you really want.
Yeah.
And so it's become very hard to shop and be like, no, you're going to get some garbage. It's okay.
Look. I'm just going to float this stuff at you, all right? This is what was on sale on Black Friday, okay?
Okay. Wait, you're not going
to
give me actual tips?
No, I was just saying, that's what you say to your kid, all right? Like, this is what was available,
I thought you were
going to
give me actual tips. I was ready.
No, God, no, I don't know. I don't know what a kid wants these days. Like, every perception I have of what kids want is loosely inspired by my step-siblings' kids, who are still fairly young. The oldest is in first grade.
Okay.
And whatever I see in the toy aisles at various stores, because I'm just, you know, like, I'm curious and I'm always, but it's just like, here's a lot of Marvel figures. Here is a lot of WWE merchandise. Sure. Here's a lot of Lego and board games. And that seems to be it. But, like, you know, my nephews and nieces, they're into a lot of, like, Disney stuff, like all kids are, but they're so young that of course they are.
But here comes the bigger problem. And I think, Brad and Alex, you would understand this, and the audience would, because what were you guys getting, let's say, on a Christmas or like, what would you want on as a big holiday gift, right? It's a
when
video game.
What age?
You got a video game.
It was always video game.
It was always video games.
Not always, but for a long stretch of my childhood.
You got a cart.
Yes, it was video games.
You got a cart. It was you got hockey. You got this. There was a cart wrapped somewhere as a gift.
Yeah.
My kids don't need video games. I am buying all the video games all
Nobody
the time.
Nobody needs video games.
No,
that's the dark secret.
No, everybody needs them. But, like, the only ones that are left are garbage games that should belong in the dumpster. But this year, I think as a stocking stuffer, and I never thought I would say these words. I certainly never thought I would say them into this camera. I think I'm getting my kids V-Bucks.
Oh, God.
Jesus.
I think.
Society has fallen.
I think we ought to talk about disasters. I think we've been playing a lot of Lego Fortnite, and I don't know if you guys remember from Fortnite, with if you don't have a skin, you get the random character generation. You get that random character. I happen to have skins, so my kids are like, how come your character doesn't change all the time? And I was like, you know, I had something from a while ago.
Some V-Bucks.
Yeah, whatever it was. They're like, can I get a skin? Can I do this? So I think V-Bucks may be in the stock.
I hate to say it, but you're right. That's probably not a bad call.
I never thought I'd be getting V-Bucks. Fortnite's become a weird platform. They're playing Lego Fortnite. I'm not gonna say it's a great game, but it's okay.
I mean that definitely strikes me as the disciplinarian approach. You want V-Bucks? You want Fortnite skins? You're gonna burn your Christmas presents to get it.
Mm-hmm. I'm not buying those for
really,
you.
You really want it that bad. This is the only way you're getting it.
Yes. Other than that, though, we're in the realm where the thing that they want is either way too expensive or, you know, it is not a thing that I feel comfortable getting them, right? Like,
right.
Like, look, could you have your own PS5? Yeah, sure. Am I buying you a $500 plus PlayStation 5? Like, hell no, that's not happening.
Not yet. There's already one in the house is the thing.
There's one in the house.
If there was no PlayStation in the house, that would be a different story. But already is one.
If a PlayStation were $50, you could have your own PlayStation and you could put it on input 2 on the TV. I don't care. Like you could have two PS5s and sitting there.
If the PlayStation was $50, we would be in a very different industry right now.
You get. I'm sure there's some game console for $50. You can. Maybe there's not anymore.
Well, yeah. No. You buy it off Timu on Facebook.
Yeah.
Let's see what the.
It has every arcade game ever.
Cheapest possible PS5 you can get. On eBay.
Oh, geez.
I bet it's broken.
Refurbed.
The cheap one is.
Yeah, it'll be hard to find because people will probably be selling busted ones for parts.
Yeah, parts only. I don't care. I'll go in there for parts. We'll see if we can make this work. I'm gonna say you could probably use $300 probably.
Oh, I'd probably more than that.
You think?
Well, maybe now that they're not so hard to find.
Some people might be trying to like offload their older ones for that new one with the removable drive and stuff, so maybe...
Oh, you can get way more like in trade-in value than that.
You can?
You can still trade one in for like $300+.
Oh, man. Okay.
I can't find any on eBay.
I would take one with like a broken port on the front, maybe. Like, oh, I snapped off my USB-C port on the front. It's broken, doesn't work. Like, all right, shave off like $50. I don't really use that port too much on the front.
Oh, wow. Even the... Okay, here's one for parts. Here's one that's listed as permanent PSN ban.
By console? Just,
console only, no power, parts as is. Those are all $200.
Jeez, really?
For consoles that are like somewhat to almost entirely useless.
Man, $200 for parts only. Yeah. That's okay. Damn. Well, that's beyond the budget anyway. Imagine you just got your kid like a parts only. I don't know, figure it out. He's way into BattleBots, so I'm been looking at BattleBot like Antweek.
Wait, like
kits.
BattleBot. Oh, right, we talked about this before. Yeah. I remember now.
They're very expensive, even for like the Antweek kits, the starter kits. My wife and I decided that we would forego for realsy. We always say we're not gonna get each other anything, but this year we said for sure we're not getting each other anything, and donate that. Whatever money we would have spent to the kids to try and see if we can get there. I do a budget every year for Christmas. That's like in my budget planning. That is, you know, I put money aside every month. So I try to stay within that budget. And that includes everything. That's like cousins, parents, the mailman, sanitation workers.
Mm-hmm.
That budget, don't break the budget. That's the rule.
Okay.
Do what you can to don't break the budget. So
don't. Break the budget.
So you got to shift stuff around, right? That's what a budget is. Yeah. So we're seeing if we can shift stuff around. But then, Brad, you had a sister. Do you feel like you ever... Do you ever feel like... Well, you have a sister. I was going to say you had a sister growing up for Christmas. Like, do you feel like you had to have like monetarily the same amount of like, did you do the math when you were guys were sitting on the, like
who got the more expensive
no,
gifts?
I don't remember ever thinking about it that way.
Okay. Like, I'm trying to think if my kids would do the same thing. Like, you know, I had two brothers growing up for Christmas, and I feel like we also did not do, like, math-wise, but you kind of compare piles, though, of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not the monetary value. It's the number of, like, gifts pile.
Yeah. So, it's very different when you're an only child, I will say.
Yeah.
You don't really think about that stuff.
Right, because you didn't have any other buddy to compete with, right?
No.
Like, she was both younger than me and also wanted, like, toys and stuff, whereas all the stuff I wanted was very expensive, so, like, I kind of realized, you know, like, I get it. The Super Nintendo was $200, I get it.
Was it not a shared gift?
No, she didn't care.
She
didn't care about games enough for it to be a shared gift.
Man.
In fact, if that had also been her gift, I don't think that would have gone over well.
Oh, man.
With her.
Did you get a lot of shared gifts?
No.
Okay.
There were not enough overlapping interests for that to really. I don't know what that would have even been, honestly.
Like with my brothers, again, I had two brothers growing up for the holidays. It was a lot of like, this one thing is too big for any one of you. This is now, here is your Super Nintendo. It is a shared between all of you gift.
Yeah.
Because like, think about how Lord of the Flies it would have been if one of us had gotten the Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
Like, no, it's mine. That's my Super Nintendo. It goes in my room, and you can't. And what are you gonna have, three Super Nintendos? No. How much was the Super Nintendo at retail? 200?
I think 200. Yeah, it was 200.
50? Yeah, you were. I think it was 200.
200, two controllers, and a Super Mario World.
Yes.
Damn,
yes.
Man.
Different time.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's.
I believe dropping backwards compatibility from the Super Nintendo was one of the ways they got the price down to 200.
Oh, was it originally supposed to have backwards compatibility?
That was under consideration, and they dropped it, I believe.
What do you think that is in today's dollars, 200 bucks? You think that's closer to 400 now?
Maybe.
I'd say closer to, yeah. It's
double yet.
How about today's dollars?
Well, dollars don't mean anything anymore.
Sorry, gold standard.
There you go.
It's an eighth of an ounce of gold.
It's all V-Bucks now.
Yes, that's right. How many V-Bucks is it?
How many skins can I get for this Super Nintendo?
One Mr. Beast and one Peter Griffin.
No deal.
Yeah, I would shoot in the dark and say probably close to 400. I'm just wondering if consoles are more expensive than they've ever been, like generally, or they're kind of on par with where they were.
I mean, we still haven't topped the PS3.
No, that's an outlier. That's
probably not. I think it's ridiculous. It's like hard to say what the value proposition is because now you only get one controller and no game. So you,
yeah, but that's a hell of a controller.
That's true. I mean, if
you got Astrobot,
yes, I mean, Astro's Playroom is still the finest game of 2020.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, if you're only playing single player games, you only need one controller, I guess. But you still have to go buy a game.
And the cost of technology has moved around, but let's assume they're much more complicated than they were than a Super Nintendo, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
more moving parts. I know technology has... probably building a Super Nintendo now would be more expensive because couldn't get the manufacturing to do that thing. But they're much more complicated, and research and development into those things probably also much more complicated.
Yes. The CPU in the Super Nintendo is 3-point-something megahertz.
Great.
If that tells you anything.
That's
never
great.
Needed more.
I think the Sony sound chip is proprietary, so I don't think you'd be able to source that unless you harvested it from a real console.
Mm-hmm.
I did come across a YouTube video getting recommended to me over the weekend of a guy building his own Commodore 64 from the ground up, though.
Wow.
Did you
apparently
do it?
That's possible now. I didn't watch the whole thing, but yeah, it seems like that apparently is possible.
Huh.
That's crazy.
So you can source all the parts?
And build a fully functional hardware Commodore 64.
That's pretty cool.
Out of entirely new parts.
That's cool as hell.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
I thought some of the chips in there were proprietary. I might have to go find that video.
Oh, yeah, I'll send you the link. I didn't watch the whole thing. I don't know for sure.
That's rad.
I did see like SID 1 and SID 2 chips in there for what it's worth, though.
Mm-hmm. And Sid Meier's in there. All right. That's going to do it. What a whirlwind.
Yeah. Definitely hit some unexpected places in that
look,
one.
Look, man, when you run a podcast where the idea is just talk about whatever.
That's right.
We will talk about whatever.
Sometimes a lot of whatever is going to come out.
You jump in the water and it just takes you. That's going to do it for the Ramblecast. If you are listening, watching to this, don't forget we've got the Watchcast. Is it up now, Alex?
It is up now. Sorry up now. For the delay. Yesterday was a little bit of a whirlwind. Uh-huh. I've been dealing with an ailing older cat, and also sorry for the bad wording on the tweet, but I did have a catastrophic computer crash yesterday.
Oh, did you say crash?
I just said crash because we only have so many characters to work with on Twitter.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to be fair, the next words were while editing the Watchcast, which I'm pretty sure I would never do while driving.
I trust you wouldn't.
Yeah, and I lost some hours of work, but I did. No files were lost, so everything is back, and it is now up live.
Great, and that is Twin Peaks. We are going to be recording the next episodes, which would be 3 and 4 this week for the next.
Four and five.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Right. We did one alone.
Yes.
4 and 5. So if you're keeping up, check those out. That'll be next week, and then on next week's podcast. I think we're kicking off. I think it's next week is our game of the year. Man, this month is collapsing quickly.
There's a lot going on.
Yes, and then during the winter break, we have between Christmas and New Year's, we'll have the part 2 of that, which will have the top 10 games of the year, and then everybody can be done arguing about game of the year because once we have ours up, we can just stop. Just let it go.
We're the definitive statement, obviously.
Thank you very much, Alex Navarro.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brad Shoemaker.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more rambling next week.